Hello and welcome to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and you're listening to episode number 22. On this week's show, we'll take some listener questions and handle some answers solo, but then on the second half of the show, Tom Hogarty, Senior Product Manager for Adobe's Lightroom, comes on to discuss the benefits of Lightroom, where it fits in our workflow, and what's likely to come in the future of photography workflows. All that coming up, so don't go away. Our first question that comes to us this week on Learning Digital Photography comes from Carl. Carl wrote into the blog regarding our last podcast, asking for a little more detail. For those of you that didn't listen, the subject of our last episode was promotion, portraiture, and planning. And he wrote into the blog commenting that he really wished there was a little more detail with regard to self-promotion and how to promote yourself and your work. And there are so many ways to promote yourself. I really don't want to try to get into an exhaustive list, so I'm going to hit on one big one, or actually two big ones. But the biggest one that I'm going to hit on is that of establishing a web presence, the internet. The internet really is an excellent, excellent way to start promoting and self-promoting your work. And the reason why is because it costs so little. There's not a lot of fiscal investment in getting things set up on the web. And the first way to get things set up on the web is to create your own web presence with a website. That means registering a domain name. For me, that domain name happened to turn out to be Canon Blogger. You may want your domain name to be your name. If you have a common name like Jason Anderson, it can be rather difficult, though, because there's a lot of Jason Andersons out there. So you're going to have to pick something unique, something easy to remember, something that's not too long, and start with creating a basic website. And you want this to be something easily rememberable, because this is what will give you easily memorable, because you don't want this to be something that people will forget. So you want your website URL, and that's the web address where your web presence is rooted on the internet, to be grounded in something easy. And it's just a web presence, a URL, a web address. And this, when you first start out, will be static and basically will just have some basic information. It'll say who you are, what kind of work you do, where to get in touch with you, what your contact information is. Maybe you'll have some references or things of that nature, but it's pretty much going to be static. You know, it's not going to be changing too much, because you want that to stay consistent. You want people to know what your email address will always be. You want people to know what your phone number will always be. You want people to know where to find you and where they will always be able to find you, and that's at your website. Once you've got that established, the next step in getting a web presence known is to incorporate something like a blog, like Canon Blogger. You want something that's dynamic, that can change, that you can add content to keep things fresh. You can add news, you can add small samples of your work, things of that nature. And Canon Blogger is a good example of that, because that has dynamic content that's always changing. So that's a second way that you can promote your work. The third way is through web galleries. A lot of people, when they're hiring photographers, they want to see examples of your work. They want to see what you've done in the past, and they want to see how much you've done in the past. And a great way to do this is through the implementation of web galleries. You can put these right on your blog, you can embed them in your website, and it's just a great way to demonstrate what you're capable of, what your unique vision is, examples of past work, maybe references to other clients that you've had. So that's another great way to promote yourself. The other way that you can promote yourself is actually by networking with others in the field. You can join social networking sites that are on the internet. And when I'm talking about social networking, I'm talking about joining things like Twitter, joining Facebook, if you want, join MySpace. There's FriendFeed out there, there's Dig, there's StumbleUpon, there's photography forums all over the place. I used to administer a photography forum. I still participate in many forums today. I've joined professional organizations like National Association of Photoshop Professionals, NAP. All right, and these are all ways that you can promote yourself by letting other people know that you're out there and that you're interested in doing work. Because, and I just got a great contract today, actually, from someone through Twitter. They wanted to find someone that could do some food photography for a restaurant here in Denver, and I said I'd be interested in doing that, and we have a connection. I've got some business now, and that may take me down another venue where I can add to my portfolio, add to my experience, add to my range of skill sets, and that can only help but to better me as I move down this road in the field of photography. So that's just one example, and that's just one example of social networking is through Twitter. You can set up a MySpace page or a Facebook page. You can connect with friends through FriendFeed. And even though you're only starting small and you may only have a few friends, they may have a friend. It'll build on that. It's like the whole Amway pyramid type thing. It can balloon out, and because there's so many connections out there on the internet, it will, if you're active and you're contributing good content in whatever venues that you're contributing to, word will spread. It may take some time initially, it may seem like you're not getting very far, but in the end it pays off the dividends, and as you establish more fingers out there on the internet, your reach will grow, your network will grow, your influence will grow, and you'll get more job opportunities and more sources of revenue that can come in, because the more you promote yourself and the more fingers you have, the better your chances are. Now, there is a caveat to this. You don't want to spread yourself too thin. You don't want to go hitting every single thing on the internet, because you're not going to be able to keep up with all of it. I participate in 2 or 3 forums. I participate in Twitter, a little bit on Facebook, but for the most part, I have my website, I have my blog, and I have the podcast. And then I'll do a little bit on Twitter, and I'll do a little bit on Facebook, and I might do even a little bit on Dig. But that's pretty much it. I don't want to spread myself too thin, because then the quality of the content that I'm contributing to each of these will suffer. So you don't want to pick up on everything and try and contribute to everything, because you'll never be able to. Pick some that work well for you, for how you work, for what you're interested in. Start building a foundation from there, and then just spread out. And in the end, it will pay off in dividends. The last thing I want to talk to you about then, as far as promoting yourself and self-promotion, is instead of just social networking on the internet, don't forget about traditional networking. Make sure you've got some business cards. Even if you're not running a business, even if you don't have any plans for running a business, put together some calling cards then. Put together a calling card with your name, your address, your phone number, maybe a sample picture or something like that for your graphic, and you can pass these out. You sit down at a restaurant, you and your restaurant companion are talking, the waiter or waitress comes up, you start talking to them, you find out they're a model, or you think they've got some great hair, or you think they look fantastic and would be a great model, throw them a business card, say, give me a call, I'd love to take some pictures of you, do it for free. You can establish a network that way. So make sure you have business cards. And if you are getting serious and you are thinking of starting your own business brand, don't forget there's also the traditional venues where you can advertise to promote your work. You can, if you want to start cheap, you can go on Craigslist. You can post ads there for free. If you've got a little bit more money, you can post ads on the radio. You can do that fairly cheaply. TV will probably be a little cost prohibitive when you're first starting out, but there is television advertising available as well. When you look at advertising that's available through radio sources, and it doesn't have to be local. You can go through XM radio. I understand they've got fairly decent rates. Throw an ad in the local newspaper. You can throw an ad on Craigslist. There are so many ways that you can network and promote yourself, both through traditional means and through the more popular and the more trendy means on the internet. There's really no way you can go wrong. As long as you're producing quality content and it's content that people will value, because if you spread yourself too thin, odds are the result of your networking efforts probably will not yield the kind of dividends you want. So it's not just about quantity, it's also about quality. It was a great question, Carl. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't put all that kind of information out there initially, but it was a great question. Coming back after the break, we have one more question actually one more subject that's going to cover a lot of questions about color space, and then we'll go ahead and segue into the interview with Tom Hogarty, Senior Product Manager for Adobe's Lightroom. I'll be right back, right after this. our second question in this week's show speaks to the subject of color spaces. And I've gotten so many questions on this subject, I'd rather not attribute them to any one particular or a couple select people because I've had so many people ask me about it. And it's a rather confusing subject because there's so many different color spaces that you can work in. And there's so many different elements of the entire process that you have to consider when thinking about color spaces. I really thought it might be best to answer this in a little more detail on the show with the question and answers, primarily because I addressed it briefly on the blog a week or two ago to try and hopefully answer it there, but really didn't give it enough time, I think, to really explain it to everyone in full detail. So to hopefully help clarify things here on the podcast, I thought I would break it down into three different segments. Basically, that being when you look at color spaces, you want to think of it in three stages: the capture phase, the post-processing, and the output phases of your entire workflow. And if you think about it, when you click the shutter, that's just the first part in the process in the digital world. You really are not finished just by pressing the shutter and capturing an image. You also have the post-processing and the output to consider when you're looking at how to manage a flow of work. And one of the big questions that I get in regard to all this, the first question, obviously, is what color space should I shoot in? And I actually learned an interesting little tidbit recently from Kerry Garrison over at Camera Dojo. It's really interesting because he said to me that the RAW workspace actually doesn't have a color gamut. And it made sense to me when I thought about it because RAW really just means that. It's raw data, and it doesn't restrict that data to a particular color space. There is no color space to raw images. So if you're asking what color space should you capture in, by definition, that means you are shooting in JPEG. And that is actually not my recommendation. I always shoot in RAW. My friends always shoot in RAW. Everyone I know shoots in RAW. However, just because we do that and I do that doesn't necessarily mean you should do that. If you're a high-volume photographer where you really don't want to deal with the file sizes and the management involved with using a raw color of raw images in your workflow, you can elect to shoot in the RGB color space if you wish to. If you must do that, I would caution you to shoot in the widest color space available to you. Some professional grade cameras have a color space called Pro Photo. Most of you will not see that as an option, though. You'll see either Adobe RGB or sRGB as your options when defining a capture color space for shooting in JPEG. The biggest clarification that I can make is that S does not stand for super. I don't know what it stands for, but a lot of people think super or sRGB is super RGB and the wider of the two color spaces, and that simply isn't the case. The Adobe RGB color space is the wider of those two, and you always want to capture, and the rule of thumb is to capture in the wider color space and then downstream move to a narrower color space, because if you capture in a narrow color space and then try to widen it later, you're going to be adding data where there was none before, so really it's just guesses at that point. So you want to shoot as wide as possible and then work your way down if you have to. So if you're defining a color space during capture, you want to define that as the Adobe RGB color space. That will hopefully answer the capture element of color spaces to work in. When it comes to the post-processing color space, this is a little more tricky because you really should be working in the color space that you're going to be outputting to at this point. Once you've pulled the images off your camera, assuming you're not in RAW, you're going to want to process in the same color space that you output to. And here again is a general rule of thumb, but if you're outputting your images to paper or a printed outlet, you're going to want to stick to the Adobe RGB color space. Adobe is the wider of the two. Most printers these days, virtually all printers these days actually, can handle that wider color gamut, so there's no reason to reduce your color space just for the ease of having a tighter control or a slightly smaller file size. So if you're outputting to print, stick with the Adobe RGB color space, and that really should be the case regardless of who you're printing to. Now, if you are using a professional grade lab, some labs do like to use the Pro Photo color space, so you may need to make a conversion inside of Photoshop or Corel Painter Pro or GIMP or whatever editor you're using. But it's recommended, again, if you're shooting in Adobe RGB, if you try to convert to the Pro Photo color space, you're going to be adding data where there was none, and it's only going to be an approximation. So if someone wants to receive a file from you or an image file from you in the Pro Photo color space, tell them the widest color space you have available is the Adobe RGB color space. Unless, of course, you're shooting in RAW, then of course you can convert to Pro Photo, which is why we recommend which is why I recommend shooting in RAW, because you can make that accommodation of professional grade printers if they request it in that gamut. Two other color spaces that bear mentioning here are the LAB color space. The LAB color space, L stands for lightness, A and B stand for channels of different colors. There's ranges of colors in the A channel, and then it's the opposing colors in the B channel. I forget which one is which right now off the top of my head. The LAB color space really can't be represented on most monitors, and for that matter, in most printers, so I wouldn't recommend converting to it unless you really know what's going on, if you've taken a couple classes from Kelby training or Lynda.com training, or you've read some of the Dan Margolis books on the subject. You really should avoid the LAB color space if you are asking questions about basic things like what's the difference between sRGB and Adobe RGB. LAB is really for professionals that really know what they're doing. I wouldn't recommend that, but because that is a color space that's available in Photoshop, it bears mentioning here. The other color space that I wanted to mention very briefly is the CMYK color space. This is primarily used for offset printers if you're printing to magazines or professional publications. Most people that listen to this podcast aren't in that audience, so I'm not going to cover it in too much detail. I will answer the question, though, what does all that stand for? C stands for cyan, M stands for magenta, Y stands for yellow, and K stands for black. So it's cyan, magenta, yellow, black for CMYK. Again, most of you won't be utilizing that color space because you're not printing to commercial offset printers that companies that produce magazines, things of that nature. If you are requested to send people files in the CMYK color space, you can do that. Again, if you must, you really want to avoid doing color conversions if at all possible, but that would mean converting at the very beginning of your workflow to the CMYK color space and then working in that color space to produce accurate prints from the images that you're working on inside of whatever photo editor you're using. Most of you, of course, will probably be using Adobe's Photoshop CS3, CS4, or Lightroom. I do know a couple people that listen that use the GIMP, though, and Corel Painter Pro. There's absolutely nothing wrong with those. They have options in there available as well. I've just not seen them because I haven't worked with those applications. So if you have to output the CMYK, know that from the get-go, so that you can do your post-processing in CMYK, so that way you're only converting once, so you don't have to convert multiple times. And that bottom line is the best answer I can give. If you know you're going to be converting from one color space to another, make sure you do that at the very beginning of your workflow so that you won't see any ugly color shifts downstream from that. Do the conversion at the beginning and then work within that color space so you get the best possible results downstream. So hopefully that answers a lot of the questions that people have had with regard to what color space to work in, where, when, and why. If anyone has any additional thoughts on that, of course, please feel free to email. The address is jason@canonblogger.com. You can also get in touch with me over on the blog. Just leave some comments there. You can fill out reviews over in iTunes. You can dig the show. Lots of ways to get a hold of me. You can contact me on Twitter. I'm under the handle CBJason for Canon Blogger Jason. I'd like to get to some more questions, but because of the length of the interview with Tom Hogarty, we've really pretty much run out of time, and I know I spent a lot of time on the color space issue, so I'm not going to have time for any more this week, but keep those questions coming. If you have questions about photography in general, if you have questions from the interview coming up with Tom Hogarty, feel free to ask those. I do always appreciate feedback, and I welcome questions from everyone. So thanks for listening, and coming up right after the break, our interview with Tom Hogarty. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. I have on the phone with me today Tom Hogarty, the Senior Product Manager from Adobe Lightroom. First off, I'd like to say, Tom, thank you very much for taking the time to stop in over at Learning Digital Photography. It's an honor to have you here.
Great. Thanks, Jason. It's good to be here.
Great. And from what I understand, you had some things from Adobe that you wanted to share with us, with the listening audience, as far as what the feature sets are, how to learn how to navigate through Lightroom as opposed to some of the other photography workflow options that are out there, and why people might want to consider Lightroom as a possible workflow option.
Definitely. I think the first thing to do is kind of explain what Lightroom is and how it relates to some products that most folks are probably familiar with, the most popular one being Photoshop itself. Currently a Photoshop CS4. It's an application. It's a piece of software that's going on 20 years in terms of age, which for a software application is quite mature. And then there's been the offshoot of that that product called Photoshop Elements, which, while not the professional-grade solution that Photoshop CS4 is still a really nice solution for your hobbyist or snapshooter. But what we saw with just kind of the explosion of DSLRs in the late 90s, early 2000 period, and digital photography just taking off for the high end of the market, we realized they needed their own dedicated solution. And so we started working on Lightroom. It was actually a seed project called Shadowland for many years internally. And the goal was, what do we need to do differently in our digital imaging solutions to help photographers deal with this computer side of the photography workflow? Because digital cameras came in and, the film experience was replaced with a compact flash card, but largely holding the camera and shooting the camera seemed the same. Then all of a sudden, everything after capturing the image became quite different. You weren't dropping your film off at a lab. You weren't getting proof sheets. You weren't getting prints. You couldn't ask the lab to push pull a whole roll of film for you. Right. So all of a sudden, all this stuff ended up on the computer. And it really required a different type of application. Because Photoshop is amazing at working with one image and doing incredibly in-depth, detailed work. That's because only one image out of maybe 1,000 was scanned onto the computer. But with digital capture, we found that we needed to provide a solution that dealt with the fact that everything, the rejects, the hero shots, and everything in between was going to end up on your computer. So how can we kind of combine all the best of Photoshop, Bridge, and Camera Raw, and create a solution that that really worked?
Okay, so it sounds like what you're saying is Lightroom is more for managing all of your photographs rather than just individual photographs one at a time. Is that an accurate kind of assessment there with regard to the function of Lightroom over other applications?
Yeah, yes, definitely. Lightroom is designed to kind of handle the workflow of, and I'll give you the quick elevator pitch. You need a digital assistant to help pull the images off the camera, quickly figure out which ones are the keepers and which ones are the rejects, so kind of refining that entire shoot. And then making kind of batch adjustments. I mentioned pushing, pulling a whole roll of film. If you notice the white balance is off or the exposure is off on a whole series of images, you can do that quickly. And then just being able to, output that set of images up to, the web or via a contact sheet or a slideshow, kind of handling that end to end. And, I don't want to downplay. In the middle, there is this develop module that does let you do some pretty nice editing. And there are a lot of templates that can give you different styles for your images. Right. But the focus is the entire experience, not just the editing, which is what Photoshop had always done in the past. It was all only about the editing and didn't really solve the end-to-end workflow.
Right. I was noticing in the develop module, that's how I was actually thinking of the comparison between the two, is that it looked like from the develop module, that was really what Photoshop used to do until this new application came along where, like you said, it handles the entire flow from beginning to end, from import, management, individual edits, and then output to either print or a website or whatever venue you're looking at. That really seemed kind of intriguing there when I first started playing with Lightroom myself. And I also noticed there was a bit of a price differential in the different applications. Like you had mentioned with Photoshop Elements, the Creative Suite CS4, and then Lightroom. I noticed Lightroom was really straddled in the middle there. And I'm wondering if that was a part of the rationale between, like, your target demographic of the, I guess it sounds like the prosumer or the serious enthusiast market up to the professional for Lightroom?
That's one of the interesting things. I kind of define the people who Lightroom should appeal to are those who, from the very top of the professional level, you know, all the way down into the hobbyist segment, and you know that's difficult to define. And so I've talked to a lot of photographers, and you know, pretty much, as you're an Elements customer, if you pull your point and shoot camera out, you know, once every 6 months to capture a birthday or an anniversary, and then you put it away, and maybe sent an image or two to grandma
or the Christmas shots or whatever, right?
Exactly. Right. But the second you pull that camera out to take an image for the sake of capturing an image, you see something, it catches your eye, and you can say, wow, that'd make an excellent photograph. You start to become inspired by photography, not just to record an event, but to actually, you know, articulate your vision. So there are phrases out there like prosumers and other things. I tend not to use those. I just, anyone who's really passionate about photography and enjoys it beyond just kind of the family record keeper, I think is a great Lightroom customer. It does make it difficult. There is a price point between Elements and Photoshop, and it's not a straight line of, you know, you move from this to this to this. It's really an entirely new product.
Right. Right, and it does seem to appeal to quite a wide variety because it is a pretty cost-effective software solution for doing pretty much anything it looks like I can think of that I would ever want to manage for myself, being, I guess, more of the digital enthusiast where I know I'm probably never going to be shooting professionally, but I know I've got a great passion for it, and I think Lightroom would be a great solution, so I'm definitely in that category as well.
Right, and when you're passionate about your images, I mean, even if you don't aspire to selling your images and becoming a full-time professional, it doesn't mean you don't want the same quality that professionals expect.
Right.
You know, and I think that's why you'll see so many, you know, professional-grade Canon and Nikon cameras in the hands of those who don't necessarily shoot professionally. You know, they're still passionate about the photography, and they don't want to sacrifice any quality.
You want the best possible image you can get with the best possible tools for both capture and processing in your post-production. I totally agree with that. Well, we had a couple listener questions and reader questions come in from the blog and over at Personal Life Media. So if you're interested, I could fire off a couple of these ones. Some of them are more detailed than the others. So if you're okay with that, we can go with a little Q&A that I got from the listening audience.
Yeah, I'd love to. Let's see what they got.
Okay, well, the first one that came in was actually a question about the RAW converters, because I guess many of us had noticed that the Elements, CS4, and Lightroom all seem to be using the same, I guess, RAW converting software for easier development. And a lot of people were wondering if that meant the same downstream effect was intended for Adobe to both ease legacy adaptation and to adapt for future innovations.
Absolutely. I mean, the way I like to put it is, you know, we're going to develop one RAW converter at Adobe.
Right.
Creating multiple iterations of kind of the same technology. I'm not going to say it never happens, but there's, you know, if you can rely on one core technology across different products, which you'll find the camera RAW technology from the very beginning was in Photoshop Elements, Photoshop, After Effects, Premiere Elements, and now the same technology is built directly into Lightroom, and it's exactly the same underlying code. So we know we've got consistency across all the products that work with RAW images. So it makes our lives easier, it makes my life easier, because I get to manage not only the Lightroom product, but also the Camera RAW plugin product.
Sure.
That supplies that underlying RAW processing technology. So, yeah, it makes it easier, and as customers move from one product to the next, all their efforts, all the work they put into their non-destructive editing, whether it's RAW or whether it's JPEG or TIFF, you know, it migrates seamlessly, which is a really nice benefit.
That is a nice benefit. It just sounds like the concept of why reinvent the wheel when you've got something that works, you know, keep it. It just doesn't make sense. Right. The other question that was kind of tangential or on the same vein as that was the Adobe DNG format that you had developed in recent years. Given the seamlessness between Elements and CS4 and Lightroom, does Adobe foresee incorporating the DNG format into the workflow and future iterations or things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, DNG is part of the workflow for the Camera Raw plugin, which is in Elements and Photoshop CS4. We've even, you know, raised it up a little bit further in Lightroom, making it easier to convert to DNG, either when you're importing your images and bring your images off the camera, or whether you're just done at the end of the day and you want to convert. So they go hand in hand, because really what you'll find with the with RAW formats, these are the formats popular in DSLRs, every single camera that comes out is essentially creating a new proprietary format. It's like having a JPEG, you know, coming out of a new camera and not being able to view it in your operating system or post it on a website and have people be able to view it because you needed to update the web browser to read that kind of JPEG. It's somewhat silly that we've gone down this path, but, you know, sometimes it takes a while for standardization to catch up with innovation.
Right.
So really all we did is we said, look, we support hundreds, well over 200 different RAW file formats. We see the similarities. Let's just go ahead and create a standard format that makes it easier for everyone to jump on board and start, you know, enjoying this RAW workflow. So that's been very successful, and we're looking forward. We submitted it to the ISO standards body for their consideration as a future standard that they would manage instead of Adobe managing it.
I remembered actually reading something about that from one of the Adobe news announcements that had been submitted to the ISO International Standards Organization, for those of you that are listening that don't know what that is, that is being considered. Had you heard any developments on that lately since it was its submission?
Well, it's a confidential process, so I'm not allowed to comment on it.
Didn't know about that. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Most people don't because it's confidential. So
makes sense.
It's something that doesn't happen overnight. But we're committed to the format.
It takes
we're
committed
to creating a standard for RAW files, no matter what. So.
And I've actually incorporated the DNG format into my own workflow. From the readers of the blog, they know that I've migrated from the Canon XT to the Canon 40D, and the transition between those two is a pretty big jump. So rather than try and adapt my workflow, I just decided to take everything into the Adobe DNG format, and I use that almost solely at this point. And that's become my digital negative, so I definitely would encourage others to take that same path as well if that's an option for them.
I did read that blog post you wrote on the topic. You know, it is a good way if you get a new camera and you realize, oh, you know what? I'm on Photoshop CS2 or CS3. Learning a new camera and a new piece of software at the same time is not always the easiest thing to do. So downloading the free DNG converter to get the latest RAW files opened up in previous versions of Camera Raw is a nice little workaround. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, and perhaps I have my own interest art here,
sure.
I think there's so much value in the Camera Raw upgrades that we provide for each release that do support the latest proprietary formats.
Right.
It's well worth looking at the latest version of Bridge, CS4, that comes with Photoshop CS4, and the Camera Raw 5 that comes with CS4. We have some amazing new technologies going on in those applications. Definitely worth checking out. Some of the stuff we added just this cycle is this concept of camera profiles. Have you given those a try yet?
I actually have. I actually purchased Adobe Photoshop CS3 Extended when I was in school, I think a year and a half ago, and I've continued to use that, and I've incorporated the Canon profiles in the Adobe RAW converter there. But I didn't realize there was a way. Was there a way to incorporate those into the DNG conversion utility as well, or is that just in the ACR?
Actually, those can be done. Let's see, with the latest DNG converter, but they're really only exposed in terms of selecting a different profile in the last version of Camera Raw for CS3 and the version of Camera Raw for CS4.
Right. right.
I'm sorry to take it back. It's tough keeping track of all the versions, but it's only exposed actually in the Photoshop CS4 camera.
Oh, okay. I thought I had seen the camera profiles in CS3 extended. I'm pretty sure I saw them in. Well, it doesn't matter. That's kind of a tangential question for the purposes of the Lightroom discussion here. yeah, we're getting way off track. Probably not questions the listeners really were expecting for the Lightroom discussion today. Let's take it back towards Lightroom. Another question that I got in, I was asking about the development process for Lightroom, and I guess this kind of ties into the life cycle of products because we've seen a fairly consistent pattern with Photoshop. Like you said, that program has been in existence for almost 20 years now, and it's getting pretty predictable as to what the pattern is every 18 to 20, 24 months, somewhere in that window is when future releases are generated. With Lightroom now in its second incarnation or second iteration there, do you foresee Lightroom falling into the same pattern of product development along the 18 to 24-month window?
Well, you know, to some extent we're leaving that up to our customers. We did an extended public beta for the first version of Lightroom that was 14 months, and then we released we actually did four significant releases during that time period. We did some extremely significant releases between Lightroom 1 and Lightroom 2 with adding major functionality in the .1 release and the .3 release.
Right.
Probably more detail than most folks want to know, but, you know, what we're doing is kind of tuning our response. We really just want to be responsive to where the industry is going. So we're not in the creative suite, as some people may notice. So we do have more flexibility to release when we think our customers need an update instead of when kind of a larger organization that's a conglomeration of many products agrees by committee when they need to ship a new version. So we have quite a bit of freedom, which is quite nice.
That's definitely an advantage when it comes to product development. Well, you probably can't answer this, but I'm going to see if I can find out anyway. Do you have any future plans for the next release of Lightroom, or is that still in development, kind of behind the scenes at this point?
We are always working on the future of the product. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say just the feedback we received from the very first public beta, we got enough feedback and enough requests to enhance people's workflow, photographers' workflow, to basically extend out to 7 versions of Lightroom, even if we're updating once every year. So we have plenty of work to do. And so we're always working on the future. We're always talking to photographers, and we talk to photographers. We kind of look at where technology is going. We look at what cameras are doing these days, and we just keep plowing ahead and hopefully making photographers happy.
Yeah, and you guys are doing a great job. I do have to say that the developments that I've seen in Lightroom, like you said, from the beta to now, I'm using a trial version of the Lightroom 2 here, and it's amazing how much you've packed into such a lightweight application. And coming from the IT side, that is what impresses me most, is the size of the footprint that Lightroom has versus its speed. It's just amazing at how efficient it is at using system resources. That's what impressed me more than the photography component aside, which is equally impressive. Its effectiveness in processor utilization really was impressive to me. So I did want to give kudos to that as well.
Yeah, we have a great team of developers and engineers and quality engineers, and you know they're extremely passionate about, you know, keeping this product lightweight, easy to use, small footprint, because you know if you're going to try a new application, you don't want to download 3 gigs of installer files, and you want to make it easy to stay current. So there's lots of little things that I think we can learn from other desktop products at Adobe and kind of how we can make our customers happy.
Right. And as it seems like also that Lightroom is really being designed specifically for photographers, and that kind of ties into another question that I got in preparation for our discussion, was this seeming convergence that's coming up between still photography and video photography and 3D photography, or not, I shouldn't say photography, but different types of multimedia. some photographers may start to have a need to develop multiple types of media, and there was a bit of curiosity as to whether or not future iterations or there may be some development down the road to where Lightroom could address different types of media. Is it going to stay solely for still photography, or are you considering other multimedia editing and managing and management as well? Because I think on the management side, it might at least be useful to see videos that are associated with some stills. So if you had like a project that had still photography and videos and you had them all in the same collection, that might be useful. But I don't know if that's something that the product team is looking at for future development. Could you
That's definitely a hot topic these days. We had shied away from video files because there are great products that work on video files at Adobe Premiere and Premiere Elements. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and when you look at which cameras supported video files, you were looking at mostly the point and shoots that just tagged on a video function.
Right.
Then all of a sudden you've got the Nikon D90 and the 5D Mark II from Canon that are capturing very high quality videos, and they're part of a, you know, passionate photographer's workflow, someone who's, you know, taking great stills but also is snapping some video at the same time. And I think that's been a game changer for a lot of us in terms of looking at how video relates to the photographic workflow. And ultimately what it will lead to is basically I'm guessing. So,
purely hypothetical here. This is all hypothetical. No one's saying anything about Lightroom specifically, but yeah, I think I get what you're going with it.
I think it's going to change the way that photographers tell stories. Right now, we still tell stories in a very traditional way. Mm-hmm. Most of the online galleries are very linear, and you know, not as interactive as they could be. I think video adds another component to digital storytelling, and adding more media and mixed media is very exciting. As always, photojournalists are on the cutting edge of all of this. They've been asked to shoot video for a long time, and if you look at some of the work that they do, whether it's posted on, I'm a big fan of the New York Times website, mm-hmm. you know, there's some great creations there that mix all kinds of media, whether it's audio files, video, stills, text, you know, quotes from people who are interviewed for a story. I think that's very exciting to me in terms of changing how we view photography.
It's definitely very exciting. I've seen a lot of photographers' websites where they're doing little video snippets to kind of set themselves apart, where they introduce themselves, give people a little quick snapshot of what their shooting style is, what their approach to photography is, what photography means to them. And it really does seem like it is, like you said, changing the face of photography and how people approach it. So it really is interesting to see what's going on there. I know that probably in order to keep Lightroom as light as it is, literally as light as it is, there probably won't be video development or video editing features, but I did think that that might be something that would be interesting to consider just as far as the asset management side of things goes. So, and kudos to I forget who it was that wrote in and asked me that, but it was a great question I hadn't even thought of until they brought it up. So,
yeah, and
the listeners.
Yeah, that was a good one. We talk about it a lot here. There's a lot of folks on the team who shoot with the 5D Mark II and the D90. You mentioned a phrase that I think it's worth talking about. Asset management.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been a lot of talk in the industry about digital asset management, and you know, it's this concept of doing the right thing in terms of storing your digital assets in an intelligent way, in an accessible way, in a future-proof way.
Right.
And there are some pretty lengthy books that go into great detail into best practices and whatnot. And but whenever you talk to a photographer, you know, it's like, what do you want to learn this year, you know, to improve your craft? It's never, well, I really want to get into this asset management thing. It sounds fascinating. you know, it's...
That's what I want to do, study files.
Yeah, it's just it's not exciting. So, I mean, what we've done with Lightroom is try and build in all those best practices into the application and kind of get you down that path without actually having to think too much about it, you know, working with metadata standards groups to make sure that everything works together well. And that's kind of the part of the job that's and the product development that's quite exciting, is to see that start to mature and see all these asset management solution or problems become obsolete because it's just taken care of automatically. And all of a sudden you realize, hey, I didn't realize I was managing my assets. It just happened.
pretty cool how that happened that way. I know one feature that's really popular on the Mac for as far as asset management goes and backups are concerned is the Time Machine. And I've actually talked with some friends that use Lightroom in conjunction with the Mac, and they are actually backing up their catalogs and their collections through Time Machine, so they have like a double safety standard there, if you will, because of the way Lightroom does the asset management, and then the backup practices also fall right in line pretty easily and seamlessly without much thinking there as well. So I thought that was a pretty cool combination when they were telling me about that.
Yeah, and I, you know, I wish other hardware manufacturers would step up and provide some backup solutions that were as intuitive and easy to use. Because what's frustrating for me is I talk to so many photographers who have lost images because they weren't backing up their computer and they didn't care about anything else on their computer. They lost some emails or maybe a couple Word documents that maybe they could find and, you know, something they sent someone else. But then they say, you know, their images are gone, and right. those are priceless.
Yeah, because you can't get those back.
Yep. those people's memories.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's all the memories that you don't want to lose. Well, that was really a lot of information there about Lightroom, and I really do appreciate that. But over at Canon Blogger and at Learning Digital Photography, we like to learn about the people behind the scenes, too. So I came up with a few questions about you and actually your work, because I know you do a lot of work as the senior product manager for Lightroom. So you obviously spend a lot of time on the management side, but had a couple of questions I wanted to ask you, if that's okay.
Yeah, fire away.
Okay, first one, how much time do you spend behind the lens? Do you do any photography work yourself?
Not nearly as much as I would like.
Of course.
I have the fortunate ability to borrow. We have a very large library of cameras at our lab here in San Jose, and I'm very fortunate to be able to borrow them and kind of test out the new capabilities and things like that. So I'm generally grabbing a new camera every few weeks to shoot and just see what's going on with new equipment.
That's pretty cool.
So that keeps me going on. It gives me little projects. I'm a new father, so that's pretty much required the purchase of several new hard drives to store all those images.
Oh, yeah. A couple terabytes worth of data there, right?
Yeah. So, but unfortunately, I haven't had any serious projects in a little while. The job is somewhat time-consuming.
Yes. Case in point.
I find myself living a bit vicariously through some of the customers and some of the stories and projects that they share, because it's I do come from a photography background. I worked in New York for several years helping professionals convert to digital, and it's just such a fun and exciting industry, and it's cool to see how new photographers are kind of expanding the boundaries. You know, photographers who've never known anything but digital.
Right.
So it's a lot of fun.
Right. Well, I know that the blog is titled Canon Blogger, so there's no pressure here or anything, but do you have a particular type of gear that you prefer to shoot with? Do you prefer Canon, Nikon, Olympus, Sony, Pentax? We're pretty much we try to be gear neutral because it is about the shot. I try and tell everyone that I talk to that it's about the shot, not about the camera. It's about actually capturing the picture. But we do always have an interest in, hey, what kind of gear do you shoot with? What do you like about this? What do you dislike about that? So that kind of begs the question, what kind of gear do you like to shoot with?
Well, I got to say, if we go back to the film days, I did have the Nikon DSLR line and all the glass that went along with that. So I do find myself shooting a lot with the new Nikons, the D3 and the D700. I love the low-light photography capabilities, and I've got some good lenses to go with that. But on the flip side,
it's fine. I freely admit that Canon does need to step it up as far as low-light handling on their sensors, because they're not there right now. They really aren't.
Nikon has the lead. I'll be honest, I've been shooting a lot with the 5D Mark II lately with the that beautiful Canon 51-2 lens.
Oh, wow.
That is and just getting some absolutely gorgeous pictures. So, but I'll go even a step further. I even put some film in my Mamiya 7 II rangefinder the other week. So I just try and – it's really about the right tool for the right job, and I'm just extremely fortunate that I don't really have to pick one.
And in wrapping things up here, I understand that you had something you wanted to give to our listeners. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Copy of Photoshop Lightroom.
Photoshop Lightroom. This is very general, very exciting. For those of you that might be interested in actually obtaining a copy of it, here's the quick rules, and I won't keep Tom too long here, but the quick rules are download a trial, edit some photos in Photoshop Lightroom, the trial version, post them over on the Learning Digital Photography Flickr discussion, and the best image decided at the end of May will win a copy of Adobe Photoshop Lightroom version 2. And if you'd be interested, Mr. Hogarty, would like to welcome you back to help judge the photos towards the end of May. We don't have to do it on a recorded call. You could just share via email some thoughts on what you think some good images are that may inspire people to be a little more creative. Would you be interested in doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to help out.
Okay,
great seeing new images and see what people are coming up with these days.
Okay, what I'll do then is I'll go ahead and throw a link to you of where people will be posting the images, and I guess we can discuss via email at some point close towards the end of May. But for those of you that are out there and don't have Lightroom yet, download a trial, edit a few, and post them up on Flickr. We'll do some judging, and we'll give a lucky winner a copy of Adobe Photoshop Lightroom 2. All right, Tom, well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to sit and talk with us here at Learning Digital Photography. Were there any closing thoughts, comments, or feedback you wanted to give us as with regard to what to be doing with Lightroom as far as our image workflow and image editing processes?
Well, I got to say, that's a big answer. So I'll just say keep track of the Lightroom Journal blog. If you could post a link to that on your site. You know, members of the team are starting to Twitter these days, so you can follow some members of the Lightroom team. We posted a blog post to link you to the Twitter accounts so you can keep track of what's going on. My Twitter is kind of boring. Basically, I'm in meetings all day, so there are other more fun members of the team who you should follow.
Well, I think I found you on Twitter actually at one point and started to do a follow and realized there weren't many posts there, so... But, definitely, if you have some people that you think would be interesting to follow over on Twitter, I'll go ahead and link them in the show notes for this episode as well. Tom, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down with us. We really do appreciate it. Very informative and a lot of fun.
Great. Thank you, Jason.
All right. Thanks. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay. Again, thank you very much to Tom Hogarty for taking the time to stop in and talk with us here at Learning Digital Photography. For those of you that will be participating in the contest to win a copy of Adobe Lightroom version 2, a couple more details for you. I've posted a thread up on Flickr in the Learning Digital Photography group. So if you go and join that group, you can share your images in there. And there's a specific thread that speaks to this contest. Go ahead and share your images in that thread. I will, over the course of the month of May, look at the images in there and I'll winnow it down, narrow it down for Mr. Hogarty so he'll choose from somewhere between 5 and 10 images rather than the probably hundreds that will be included. So you want to make sure that you're posting them inside that thread. The other rule is that 2 images maximum per person. So if I see 3 images in there from one person, that's fine. I'm going to take the first 2. Also keep in mind that you want to edit these in Photoshop Lightroom because you want to start getting used to that since you're going to be winning a copy of it. So make sure you're doing your editing in Lightroom. You can download a trial for free from Adobe.com. So do go over, visit the website, download a copy for your operating system. They have it for both Windows and Mac. Edit them up, post them up in the Flickr group, and the winner at the end of May will get a copy of Photoshop Lightroom from Adobe. Thank you very much to Tom Hogarty for contributing that and starting the first contest here at Learning Digital Photography. That's it for this week. Show. If anyone has any questions, comments, feedback, you know how to reach me by email. It's jason@canonblogger.com. You can share comments over at the blog, which is canonblogger.com. You can also catch up with me on Twitter. My handle over on Twitter is cbjason.com. And you can also contact me through my website, Jason's Photography. That's jasons-photography.com as well. Thank you everyone for tuning in. Thank you again to Tom Hogarty from Adobe for taking the time out to stop in. This is a very exciting show. We're getting on near an hour now, though, so I do want to wrap things up. Again, everyone, thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Have a good one, and happy shooting. Bye.